This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson. Tonight, will the states and territories planning a Christmas reopening hold their nerve as COVID and Omicron infections tick up? Also, the Prime Minister's confident all 5 to 11-year-olds who want a COVID vaccine will have it by the time school goes back, but rollout-weary doctors aren't so sure.
We're going to do the best we can. Obviously, GPs are going to step up again for their communities. But we know it's a big task. We've got the 8-week interval, which will probably help in some ways in terms of spacing out the doses and getting everyone at least first dosed.
And there's flooding in the east while communities in Western Australia are battling bushfires. Accusations are flying that we're still ill-prepared.
It's becoming ever increasingly hard because of so many regulations. The bottom line is, for us, I'd like to see a lot more bush burnt so that we're actually protected.
Fire management needs to transition into thinking about it as a land management activity as opposed to an emergency response activity.
Thanks for your company. Cases of the coronavirus and the Omicron variant are ticking up across Australia as states reopen their borders and the silly season approaches. It's causing yet more problems for business owners who say they're facing Christmas cancellations amid uncertainty about travel restrictions and quarantine for COVID contacts. But with vaccination rates relatively high, one expert says we should be confident we can avoid lockdowns and more border closures while still avoiding the worst effects of the virus. Nell Whitehead has more.
After a long year, business was supposed to be going back to normal this Christmas for South Australian wine tour operator Terry Chirk McCoy.
We thought that the opening the borders on the 23rd was going to open us up with opportunities.
But with COVID cases ticking up across Australia, Christmas parties this year look like prime transmission sites. And despite assurances from politicians, travel rules still seem unpredictable. And Chuck says the cancellations are coming thick and fast for his McLaren Vale company, Chuck's Little Winery Tours.
Now, we're all used to cancellations over the last 2 years, but we thought that by becoming 80% double vaxxed, we would be able to start trying to trade a little bit more freely. But in fact, what it's done is it's given our guests more uncertainty.
All told, the pandemic's cost his business $380,000. And just when hope should have been around the corner, he's more worried than ever.
I used to be able to run, you know, $7, $8 million businesses in years gone by. Now I'm struggling to hold together this one. I'm not a depressed person, but I do get little bits of anxiety where I start to wonder where my business is going.
With Christmas just over 2 weeks away, COVID clusters are seeding in big social venues. 3 cases of Omicron have been found so far among people who went on a Sydney Harbour boat party, and New South Wales Health says it's expecting more to come. It recorded 516 new cases yesterday, the highest daily figure in about 2 months, while Victoria had 1,206, though its numbers are more stable. And the virus is now spreading in Queensland. Here's its Health Minister, Yvette Darth.
Today is the day that we've been planning for. I can report that we have new community cases here on the Gold Coast. We do have 6 people on the Gold Coast who have been in the community infectious for a number of days.
That's already making some states jumpy. South Australia's Premier Stephen Marshall says he's concerned new cases there may be the Omicron variant. And he's sent all close contacts into 14 days of quarantine, whether they're vaccinated or not. But Jane Halton, who's chair of the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, says there's no reason to panic.
Well, we were always expecting to see an increase in cases as we relaxed a number of the previous rules. I don't think anybody should be too alarmed that we're seeing exactly what we expected. And of course, we now have significant numbers of the population who are vaccinated. So that gives a pretty good level of protection across the community.
Pfizer's initial research suggests 3 doses of its vaccine will be needed to deliver the same protection for Omicron as 2 did against Delta, and that a 4th shot may be needed 1 year after the 3rd.
But I think we should remember that we've had this experience before where a new variant, some of the vaccines aren't quite as effective, but they still give us really good protection against severe disease and death.
And Jane Halton says there's no need for states to change tack on their reopening.
There is a time, and to use that expression, where you do have to get back out from under the doona. And I do think in all these states and territories, and they're now saying the cost and the benefit of where we've been, we all understand, but we do now need to give people back their lives. So, yes, there are going to be COVID cases. COVID is going to be endemic in Australia like it is in the rest of the world. But we can manage this if we're careful, if we're thoughtful, and if people make sure they firstly do finish the first job of vaccination, but secondly, then they get their boosters when they're told they should get them.
In McLaren Vale, Terry Chook-McCoy is hoping for some consistency this Christmas too.
I would like to see Australia get back to one country, not seven different little pockets, and that way we can move forward confidently.
That's wine tour operator Terry Chook-McCoy ending that report from Nell Whitehead. Children aged 5 to 11 can soon join the ranks of the vaccinated people in Australia, with the expert advisory group ATAGI approving the use of a smaller dose of the Pfizer vaccine for that group. Jabs will start going into little arms on January the 10th. And the Prime Minister says he's confident the more than 2 million kids in that age group will have the opportunity to get their first dose before school goes back. Samantha Donovan reports.
More than 5 million primary school age children in the United States have had their modified doses of the Pfizer COVID vaccine. And the Health Department Secretary, Professor Brendan Murphy, says the Australian authorities reviewed the American data closely before approving the jab for youngsters here.
The adverse effects for this vaccine for little children are almost negligible. It is really safe. We've now got very, very, very good data that this vaccine has only the usual mild sore arms, very, very, very good experience from the US. So I'm very confident that the Pfizer vaccine is a safe and effective vaccine, and I strongly encourage everyone to get it.
The Director of General Medicine at Melbourne's Royal Children's Hospital, Dr. Sarah McNabb, has no hesitation in recommending the Pfizer vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds.
We know that for most children in that primary school age group who get COVID, the symptoms are usually mild, and some children have no symptoms at all. But we have seen some children who have become more unwell, either with acute COVID, so with respiratory illness from COVID, or also from a condition called pediatric inflammatory multisystem syndrome, which comes on about a month to 6 weeks down the track and has caused some children to be more unwell.
Dr. McNabb says about 10 Victorian children have had the syndrome, and there's roughly one case for every 3,000 children who get COVID. But the US data is showing 5 to 11-year-olds tolerate the vaccine well.
Pleasingly, we're not seeing an alarming safety signal at all. So cases of side effects from this vaccine are extremely rare in this age group. And certainly the benefits of being vaccinated are outweighing any risks of vaccination.
The vaccinations for primary school-age children will be offered by GPs, pharmacists, Aboriginal health services and state-run clinics from January the 10th, less than 3 weeks before Term 1 begins. Bookings will open later this month, and ATAGI has recommended an 8-week gap between doses. And there's a bit more work to be done ahead of the rollout. The TGA has to batch test the Pfizer doses, which are a third of that given to people 12 and over, and healthcare workers are going to be trained in giving vaccinations to young children. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is confident all 5 to 11-year-olds will have the opportunity to get their first jab before school starts next year.
Yeah, well, we start on the 10th of January, and that leaves ample opportunity, I think, to do that. But ultimately, that's a decision for parents.
The states and territories will be responsible for any vaccination clinics in schools. The Australian Education Union is keen to see as many primary school-aged children vaccinated before school goes back in late January. But its federal president, Karina Haythorpe, agrees it's a tight timeline.
It's unfortunate that the rollout cannot commence earlier than the 10th of January. I think it underlines the need to ensure that when the rollout starts, it is smooth and efficient. But the reality is it's going to be very difficult to get around 2 million children having their first vaccination before the back-to-school period begins.
The Royal Australian College of General Practitioners also has concerns about the timeframe for vaccinating 5 to 11-year-olds. Its president, Dr. Karen Price.
we're going to do the best we can. We're used to doing vaccinations, and obviously GPs are going to step up again for their communities. So, you know, we know it's a big task, and undoubtedly we've got the 8-week interval, which will probably help in some ways in terms of spacing out the doses and getting everyone at least first dosed. Hopefully parents are understanding that we've only got so much capacity and that we're going to do the best we can. We know that the state hubs are closing and some pharmacies are pulling out, so general practice is really going to be having to significantly step up.
Dr. Price, given the increased workload for GPs, are you getting paid enough to offer the shots to little children?
Well, we have been calling for more support and more resources, and up to 50% of practices have reported losing money on the rollout already. So it is a big job, but GPs are committed to the public health need and also to their own patients. So I think that needs to be resourced properly.
That's the President of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, Dr. Karen Price, speaking to Samantha Donovan. While large parts of the East Coast remain on flood watch, communities in Western Australia are scrambling to deal with out-of-control bushfires. Australia's always been a nation of climate extremes, but experts say it's getting worse and it's due to climate change. With preparation key to managing these events, researchers and farmers say we can be doing more to minimise their damaging effects. Matt Bamford reports.
Flying low above dense bushland, a water bomber dives towards the flames. Western Australia's southwest is in the midst of another bushfire emergency. Two blazes are threatening homes and property around the tourist towns of Margaret River and Busselton. Locals like Fletcher have had to flee their homes.
I've loaded up the car with all our personal stuff and taken the pets and, gonna work out what's the next step, I suppose.
It's early in the season, but communities across the state have already seen several emergency fires unfold. Heavy winter rains have led to more plant growth across the state, so there's more fuel for fires. Rob Webb is from the National Council for Fire and Emergency Services in Australia and New Zealand, or AFAC.
At this stage, parts of the southwest and further up towards the Pilbara are looking at above average conditions.
He says it's an obvious side effect of rising temperatures.
One of the clearest indicators or clearest, most confident predictions in a changing climate is that the fire seasons will become more severe and longer. So although you can't hold any of these individual fire events to climate change, it's consistent with what we'll see more of.
It highlights the importance of early prevention, something dairy farmer Ross Woodhouse undertakes every year. As the Margaret River blaze burns just kilometres away, he's feeling in control. But he'd like to see efforts for prescribed burning increase to reduce the fuel load during summer.
It's becoming ever increasingly hard because of so many regulations. We have permits in place early November, but the bottom line is for us, I'd like to see a lot more bush burnt so that we're actually protected.
Summer has become a stressful time of year for his family.
Every year we live in fear of fire because we're surrounded by lots of bush, and lots of that bush hasn't been burnt for 30 years.
But it's a risk in populated areas like the southwest, where an out-of-control blaze could be fatal.
You know, by being risk adverse, I suppose at the end of the day, nobody wants to light a fire. As soon as you light a fire, you're creating a risk, aren't you? So maybe we're doing something wrong. Maybe we need to revisit it. That's all I'd say. The lack of reduction burning is setting us up for a disaster.
It's also an issue in remote Australia. In the past 2 months, fire has ravaged 120,000 square kilometres across the top end. Rowan Fisher is a professional fire mapper from Charles Darwin University.
Fire management needs to transition into thinking about it as a land management activity as opposed to an emergency response activity. It's almost like we're getting there too late. I mean, it's a real struggle in southern Australia where fuel loads are very high and the risk to property and life is more extreme.
He says fire management practices across Australia are worryingly underutilised.
But we really need to think how we can engage with looking back to traditional practices, working with local people, working with Indigenous people, and how we can try and use technology to reinstate some of these sort of fuel reduction burns.
He's seen prescribed burns make a big difference.
We can track using satellite technology all the fires that occur across the north, and we do so every week, and we're able to compare what the fire regimes were like a decade or so ago when there wasn't so much support for burning on country and what they're like now. And over vast swaths of the entire northern part of our continent, there has been a measurable reduction in fire frequencies.
And while fire is furthest from the minds of those on the east coast, Rowan Fisher says the threat is not far off.
I think people forget how closely water and fire are linked. So we really need to think about the cycle of rain and fire and manage that in the long term.
That's professional fire mapper Rowan Fisher from Charles Darwin University. Matt Bamford, our reporter. You're listening to PM on radio on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm David Lipson. Ahead, Australia's bogong moth at risk of extinction. We'll explain why that matters and the implications for alpine areas.
They transfer around 5,000 gigajoules of energy into the alpine ecosystem. That's really, it's around 2.5 million Big Macs. That's a lot of food and a lot of energy going into that system.
Cyber criminals have struck again. Tens of thousands of South Australian government employees, including police, doctors, nurses and politicians, have had their personal details stolen in a large-scale hack on the state's payroll system. It's operated by an outsourced company. The hackers gained access to the names, addresses, tax file numbers, dates of birth and bank details of at least 38,000 staff and possibly as many as 80,000. Here's Rhett Burney.
South Australia's Treasurer Rob Lucas is used to talking numbers, but rarely in the context of a major cyber attack. This afternoon, he revealed at least 38,000 public servants have had their personal details stolen by hackers in a ransomware attack on the state's payroll system.
It's obviously of major concern that there has been this particular breach. And my press release, and I repeat again, I, on behalf of the government and the public sector, apologise to the many employees who will be concerned at the fact that their personal information has been accessed by someone.
Rob Lucas says all up 80,000 public servants could be caught up, including doctors, nurses, admin staff and MPs. Their names, birth dates, tax file numbers, bank account details and salary were hacked in an attack on the company that runs the state's payroll, Frontier Software.
The only group I'm advised that we can definitely rule out at the moment, it's a big group, obviously, teachers of the Department for Education, they're the only group at this stage that we can rule out.
In a statement on its website, Frontier Software said the attack actually happened in November. It wasn't until Wednesday this week that it found SA's public service data had also been breached. Professor Matt Warren is the head of the RMIT Cybersecurity Centre.
This information is so sensitive to an individual in terms of how that data could be misused.
Matt Warren says there's no telling exactly where the information will end up, but he's got a fair idea.
If they have stolen data, what they'll do is then sell it on in the dark web, where they have marketplaces where, you know, megabytes and terabytes of data, you know, can be sold for hundreds of dollars.
The SA government is offering support to tens of thousands of staff affected. It's urging them to consider changing banking passwords and be aware of suspicious activity on their accounts. It's also engaged ID Care, a company that specialises in protecting personal info. Staff can ask them to help map out the risk of identity theft and fraud. So given this sensitive data was stolen from an attack on an outsourced payroll provider and not the state government itself, aside from the criminals, is anyone else to blame? Matt Warren says no.
Any organisations can be now potential victims, in whether they're large or small, whether it's government, whether it's Commonwealth, state or local. The issue is not necessarily trying to blame organisations, but it's trying to understand what's happened and then learn from what's happened.
That's Professor Matt Warren, the head of the RMIT Cybersecurity Centre, speaking with PM's Rhett Burney. The Australian Defence Force is scrapping its troubled fleet of European-designed Taipan helicopters and will replace them with up to 40 American-made Black Hawks and Seahawks. It comes after years of maintenance problems with the Taipan and a basic design flaw. The door is too narrow to allow its gun to fire while troops are descending from the aircraft. The decision comes just 3 months after the government ripped up its deal with the French to provide a fleet of submarines in favour of US-designed nuclear-propelled submarines. Defence Minister Peter Dutton said it sends a clear message to our partners and adversaries that Australia is serious about defending itself.
The Black Hawk replacement is also going to be incredibly efficient. It will be much cheaper to run than the current Taipans, and we found the Taipans to be unreliable. They haven't lived up to expectation, and if we want the safest possible airframe for the men and women of the Australian Defence Force, then the Black Hawk was the obvious choice.
For more, I spoke to Professor Peter Dean, the Director of University of Western Australia's Defence and Security Institute. Peter Dean, thanks for your time. Operationally, is this the right move?
Yes, I think it is, particularly if you look at the government's figures and if we assume that they're correct and over the long term this will actually save the Australian taxpayer quite a bit of money. But the issue with the Taipan helicopters we've had for quite a while now has been their serviceability. So this is a capability that's often been down for maintenance. It's often had periods of time where it's been grounded. And this has been an ongoing concern for the Army about the availability of this capability.
They've never really met their expectations, have they? And you know, with that in mind, who's to blame for holding on to them for so long?
No, they haven't. The fleet theoretically should be able to stay in existence. These are not old helicopters. They're not old platforms. They should be able to stay in service for a considerable period of time. Certainly, there's a number of European companies that operate them. I think you could trace this back to the original decisions. There were some concerns that the National Audit Office raised about the way the procurement was done. And certainly...
This was by the Howard government.
Yeah, and what I think defence at the time was very much trying to be forward looking in time and trying to get a capability that would evolve over time. But clearly, what's happened and this hasn't been the right capability, and I think the government has made the right decision to cut it loose.
So again, we're turning to the Americans to supply us with military hardware, and again, we're snubbing the Europeans along with the AUKUS deal and the nuclear submarines, which obviously was a much bigger deal than this. Does all of this, though, added up, erode our sovereignty, as some have suggested, for us to be so reliant on the US?
No, not at all. I don't think the sovereignty issue is really a key one. This still doesn't affect the Australian government's ability to make sovereign decisions about whether and when it uses our armed forces in Australian national interests. You know, we don't have any of our Air Force fleet built here in Australia, and most of our other capabilities, there's a mixture of those that are built here in Australia or assembled here in Australia, but also a lot of what we call military off-the-shelf purchased from overseas.
So you don't buy the claim that buying this hardware from overseas, particularly the Americans, irreversibly entangles us with the US and locks us into any potential conflict, for example, over Taiwan?
Absolutely not. I mean, it's military capability in this sense. What the Army and Defence are looking for is the best military capability to serve our needs. Now, of course, you know, this is built off the back of the very close relationship we have with the United States and the very long-term partnership. But in the end, we remain a sovereign, independent state, and we remain having the ability to make sovereign, independent decisions. Having a close, abiding capability relationship with the United States makes it easier for interoperability, easier when we do things together in partnership for our military forces to operate together. But it doesn't lock us into anything directly, the same way that, you know, buying F-35 aircraft or other military capabilities by Japan, by the European countries, by the Middle East countries, don't lock them into any loss of sovereignty either.
What about the perception of sovereignty? I mean, in terms of the way China, for example, frames the switch to American Black Hawks and American submarines, does being seen to be cozying up to the Americans, obviously we're already very close, but does that put a bigger target on Australia's back?
I don't think it puts a bigger target on our back. I mean, what it does is provide plenty of fodder for the sort of wolf warrior diplomacy take that they have. And it plays into a narrative that they're attempting to spin about the sort of relationship between Australia and the United States. But in the end, the United States exports major military equipment to all two different countries. And if you look at one of our other defence partners, India, who we've signed a recent defence pact with last year, that we're a part of the Quadrilateral Security Agreement Organisation and that we're doing more military exercises with. They purchase a significant number of their capabilities, for instance, from Russia. And that doesn't make the Indians beholden to the Russians in terms of sovereignty or any of these issues. On the China issue, it's convenient for them to paint a narrative around this that suits their own national interests. And they'll do that no matter where they can find an opportunity to do that.
Professor Peter Dean, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That's Peter Dean, the director of the University of Western Australia's Defence and Security Institute. We have iconic Australian animals, kangaroos, koalas, but if you had to pick an iconic Australian insect, a bogong moth might spring to mind. They were often known to swarm the lights at Parliament House, sometimes the hallways too, and even made headlines landing on a singer during the Sydney Olympics. But today they've been added to the International Union for Conservation of Nature's Red List of Threatened Species, a leading global scientific assessment of extinction risk. They and 123 other Australian plants and animals are on this year's list, and experts are warning it's another red flag that we're losing wildlife fast. Here's Alexia Atwood.
Senior research scientist at the Australian Museum, Andrew Mitchell, was caught off guard by news that the bogong moth is among the species added to the red list.
I was shocked, frankly. It was hard for me to believe that an insect that's so widespread and so iconic should be placed on the endangered list.
The moth expert knew the species was having a rough time, particularly with the recent drought, but he was predicting they'd rebound. He says their decline is wreaking havoc on food chains, leaving other species like the critically endangered mountain pygmy possum starving.
They transfer, it's estimated, around 5,000 gigajoules of energy into the alpine ecosystem. That's really, it's around 2.5 million Big Macs. That's a lot of food and a lot of energy going into that system. And in the last 3 years, it just hasn't been there.
Of the 124 new additions to the red list, 54 have been categorised as either critically endangered, endangered or vulnerable, which includes the grey-headed flying fox, green-lip abalone, Arcadia velvet gecko and several insect species from Kangaroo Island. Dr. Jessica Marsh is an honorary research associate at the South Australian Museum and lives on Kangaroo Island. She was the person responsible for coordinating the assessment of invertebrate species, meaning she gathered a group of experts to nominate which species they believe were most in trouble because of the recent bushfires.
A lot of people don't like insects and bugs and spiders. And I think by producing these lists, it really does highlight that these species are at threat and also that they are really important. Our world depends on them. And by getting a better representation of invertebrates on these lists, which usually are very much skewed towards your mammals and your birds, it kind of helps to bring more attention to invertebrate species.
It's not just ecosystems we need to worry about. A decline in the bogong moth could mean future generations are missing out on an important food source. That's because climate change threatens food security. But if we can overcome the mental hurdle of eating insects, they could become an important source of protein. Olympia Yaga is the CEO of GoTerra, a company that designs technology to better manage food waste and tackle the climate crisis.
The bogong moth tastes a little like it has a texture of pseudo chicken, but it's got a more nutty flavour and a little bit more of a umami fish taste, which is it's really lovely.
Yeah, so would that be one of your favourite insects to eat and the ones that you can probably convince the most people to try?
It hasn't really got there yet. We have a CSIRO project that we're working on around Indigenous species to Australia that are capable of being used for human consumption. When you think about food that is good to eat. We want things that are homegrown. We want things that are part of our culture, and we want things that taste good in our diet.
Andrew Mitchell from the Australian Museum says while we're noticing the decline of species like the bogon moth, they're really the canary in the coal mine.
I would imagine that there are a lot of additional species that live in the same area that are equally threatened. It's just that we don't have the data on it. We need lots more research to try and establish what other species might be of a conservation concern.
That's Andrew Mitchell from the Australian Museum, Alexia Atwood reporting. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Cody, technical production by Scott Johnston and Alan Arthur. I'm David Lipson.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.